Hi, I'm Rachel Smith, and this is the MadTech Podcast, fast and furious news for the MadTech generation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the MadTech Podcast. Delighted to welcome our special guest today, Kat Agostino, COO and co-founder of Imagine Insights, and also co-founder of the Dawn Network, which is a women's network for those working in advertising, media, and marketing. Did I get all of that right, Kat?
You did. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very pleased to have you. And hello, Lindsay. And are you proud of me? I got Kat's name right. I got the job title right.
I am in absolute shock.
And the name as well. That's good. The good that you got the name right.
I mean, yeah. Kat, to be honest, well, I really believed that she'd butcher your name. I really did. It's just shocking. Really is. Well done, Rachel.
You have little faith, Lindsay. I'm getting better. Okay, so new format, snappy, 10 minutes per topic. We're going to jump straight in. First news story I wanted to discuss with the two of you today is about the Privacy Collective, which is an industry privacy group, bringing forward class action claims against Oracle and Salesforce in the UK and also in Holland. They're bringing claims against Salesforce for their use of third-party cookies, saying that their application and use of third-party cookies for personalised advertising and online advertising is against the rules of GDPR. Now, this sounds like a very sort of familiar argument insofar as we know that the ICO here in the UK, who is the Data Protection Authority in the UK, went into quite detailed reports into the ways in which the advertising technology industry supported personalised advertising, what techniques and tools they use for that, specifically how RTB is enacted and whether that contravened any data privacy laws and any data privacy rules. So this feels as though these claims are sort of bought on the back of some of that language, although maybe I'm just, you know, unnecessarily threading a few things together. Really interested to hear what both of you think about this. It feels like a very important moment for the ad tech industry. Obviously GDPR we've been living with for a couple of years. But these are two big marketing technology companies, and are these lawsuits going to have legs? And what do we think Oracle and Salesforce are going to be saying in response to them? Kat, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's a huge scandal. I mean, you know, not obtaining consent is a massive deal, and I think Privacy Collective are unlikely to investigate without due concern. It will open up the door, I think, to further investigations, but I do think that it isn't necessarily a bad thing if companies can prove that they're operating as they should be. So I think it's, you know, there's definitely legs to it. But I think, you know, it'd be good to discuss like some of the weeds in terms of the claims that have been made. I mean, I know people that work at Oracle, I know people work at Salesforce, and they would claim that, you know, they are doing everything by the book. So it's whether those claims are, you know, grounded in proof and insight, really.
Mm, that's the key point, right? Lindsay, to what extent do you think that the detail of the way in which Oracle and Salesforce might use and apply personal data is actually going to be contravening GDPR without working at either Oracle or Salesforce?
Yeah, bearing those two things in mind, it's an interesting one, because the one thing I was going to say was we don't yet know what the purpose of this data collection is or has been and whether it was easy to opt out of it. And that's what I think will be a big That's what I think will be a big argument against the lawsuit from both Oracle and Salesforce. But I think that there's a lot to be said for Kat. I think you're absolutely right when you said that even if this turns out that everything was above board, everything was legitimate, there is absolutely no harm to this actually coming to the fore, because it does mean that this investigation will set a precedent for, you know, whether we think that you're doing this compliantly or not, we will be investigating you. And is this the start of GDPR regulation? Is it the start of going after enterprise tech to then kind of show to the rest of the industry, look, we are serious about this, we will go after you guys? So I don't know how easy it will be for them to be able to prove legitimacy, proof of compliance, or even where the data's come from. But it's something that I think will be everyone will be watching very with great interest.
Yeah, and I think, you know, GDPR is, you know, it's not a new thing. It's been around for a while. And, you know, the reason GDPR is there is to help the industry to clean up processes and to refocus personalization and targeting. And that's a good thing. You know, that's only a good thing, but it will be really interesting to see how Oracle and Salesforce, you know, fight back in this. And I think, yeah, that's, as Lindsay was saying, that's the really interesting thing here.
Yeah, I think this is the start of things to come, and there'll be many questioning why nothing's come sooner, why we haven't seen these kind of big lawsuits happening so far, given GDPR's only been around for a few years. But I think that they've probably been building their case that entire time. I think my question is why are they starting, if they're going after any enterprise tech, why is this privacy collective going after the likes of Oracle and Salesforce? They wouldn't be the go-to big enterprise tech companies you think of as kind of non-compliant to GDPR when it comes to advertising. It makes me wonder if you know, if it's just too difficult to go after Google and Facebook at this stage, and Oracle and Salesforce are a good starting point, maybe.
Yeah, maybe there's so many claims against, you know, Google and Facebook for other things that, you know, they're focusing on other companies for this particular area.
Yeah, they've got to find some room in the, you know, or take a number and join the queue when it comes to wanting to put lawsuits forward against Google and Facebook. I mean, I wonder, there was two things I was wondering. The first is that, you know, I'd read in some of the articles relating to this piece that, you know, one of Oracle's counterclaims that they'll be putting forward is that they're not involved in the RTB process, so therefore they can't be held responsible for the ways in which some of the more detailed mechanisms of the ad tech kind of chain undertakes data sharing and data processing. And if we remember the ICO report from last year, that was one of the big claims that they were making, was that RTB, real-time bidding, as an actual technological process, can't possibly have sought consent from every single piece of data that it's using in order to enable that auction process, that instant auction process. And that made me think, well, then aren't we just returning to this same sort of debate that we were having with the ICO last year, which is how much of this is actually about protecting users' privacy and having users' best interests at heart, and how much of it is about, I suppose, potentially attacking you know, parts of the advertising technology chain for trying to, you know, create profitable business models out of personalised advertising.
I think it ties in a lot to the conversation around there's still confusion around data processing and data controlling, and this definitely ties into that. And I think what the ICO have said is, you know, that the ICO's point on this would be you claim to have no part in the RTB process, but you're still tackling with third-party data. So if you're still tackling third-party data, then you are in some way processing it, be it part of the RTB process or not, which makes you liable for this. And that's what I think the argument, the counter-argument would be to that.
Yeah, and it's also not just, you know, we've got to think about everybody in that process as well. You know, there's a lot of people that operate in that process, from trading desks to, you know, to the buy and supply side. So I think you have to, you know, think of it as a whole, rather than just singling out, you know, specific companies.
Yeah, 100%. Time's up, unbelievably. Tell you what, 10 minutes just whizzes on by, doesn't it? And then it takes me about another minute or so to reset the time clock. Right, next story. Go on, what were you going to say? Trying to interrupt me there.
Well, I did just want, I didn't manage to get my story in the latest ridiculous ad that I've received from non-targeted advertising, which is why we have to remember that targeted advertising is important, but in the right context. Land drainage and sewer treatment solutions.
What have you been Googling?
I'm a thinker. I'm a farmer.
Well, I got a Viagra ad today, so I don't know what that says about me.
Brilliant. Love it. Okay, second news story. This news story is warming my dark heart. It is about the Google lashing out against the Australian Competition Authority, known as the ACCC, as they're continuing their consultation ahead of implementing a news media bargaining code. Now, we spoke about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, that the ACCC were going ahead with their plans to implement this code. They're now in a consultation period. And what's really interesting is that there's been a lot of coverage in the news news this week about how Google is trying to put forward claims that the code is unfair. Now, I mean, I find it very hard to introduce this story without just, you know, without just raining cynicism down on this. So you two will have to help keep me on track here. But, you know, Google are unbelievable, right? You know, they came out at the start of this process when the ACCC announced that they wanted to implement something like this late last year. They came straight out the gate and said, well, actually, we don't make much money off news in Australia anyway. So, you know what? Do what you want. And so they have, and now Google have said, wait, this is outrageous. It's completely unfair. It's going to preference large news organisations over small news organisations. And furthermore, the big thing that's kicked up this week is that they're implementing, or that they've undertaken a campaign, an awareness raising campaign, using air quotes here, but they were actually, you know, making their views explicitly clear to every single Google user in Australia during the week, with various pop-ups, an open letter that they've drafted, and starting to state that Australians might get restricted use of Google assets, including search, YouTube, etc., as a result of this media bargaining code. The ACCC are being straight down the line about this. They issued a letter on their website saying, actually, this is misinformation. You know, there is nothing in this media bargaining code that would be forcing Google to restrict use of any of their assets by Australian users, or charge for any of their assets. If Google chooses to do that, they're doing that under their own steam. So interested to hear your opinions on this. Kat, what do you think?
I mean, firstly, I think the open letter, I mean, it's more than open, right? I'm not a fan of scare tactics. And, you know, that part of it, I find really, really hard on. If you're a company that is putting your users first, and then you are effectively scaring them with misinformation, I don't think that's the right approach to take. And as you said, it is, if you go in and you really do start to read, and I've kind of done that over the last few days, is to look into a bit more. And it's not, you know, as Google say it is, and it isn't about, it's trying to create more of a value exchange around, you know, and around these news publishers. And, you know, a lot of news publishers have folded. And so why shouldn't there be a better bargaining tactic? Why shouldn't there be more of a discussion about how that information is shared and the news is shared with Google? I'm kind of for the news publishers in this and the code in this aspect. But as I said, I wouldn't want to just diss Google on it. But I think the way that they've scaremongered people and the ad that they've put out is not the right approach for users.
Yeah, well, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, it feels like total bully boy tactics to me. Lindsay?
I mean, this is just bizarre. I just, and Google have come out and said, no, Australia, we'd never said we were going to charge for free services. We said they are at risk. And it's like, well, what's the bloody difference? You either charge for them or you're going to remove them. Like, either way, you're threatening free services because you're getting in a tiz with the government. I mean, it's ridiculous. And the one thing I love about Australians, if nothing else, is that they are highly cynical. So I really hope that as a nation, they will look at this and go, that they will call bullshit on it, because it's just ridiculous. As Kat says, the scare tactics that Google are employing here are just ridiculous. Like, it's not a way to do business. It's ridiculous. And the ACCC are onto something here. The approach they want to take in charging for quality journalism is a good idea. We talked on the podcast the other week about, will that impact the smaller players in this? Is it only going to help fund big news journalism like the likes of News Corp, or will it actually help smaller journalists? And obviously Google have decided they don't care about that side of the story anymore, so they're going after YouTube instead and telling YouTube creators that YouTube may be obligated to give large news publishers confidential info about our systems that they could use to try to appear higher in YouTube rankings, which could mean creators would receive fewer views and earn less. I mean, it doesn't actually make any sense. It's completely spurious. YouTube is saying, we may have to give News Corp detailed information about YouTube, which means that you small guys might earn less. It's actually completely nonsense.
But also, we know Facebook's opinion, they haven't come out in this way. You know, it's also affecting them, this code, but they've just kind of rejected it and said, oh yeah, it won't affect our bottom line. And that's kind of it. So I think, you know, that's just an interesting thing to see as well, that the way that they're both approaching the code. And I think, you know, it's maybe that this code will set a precedent, you know, but isn't this more about ethics, you know, having a code for ethical practice as opposed to anything else?
Yeah, exactly. Really, you're saying our nation of 20 odd million people, they're giving you tons of revenue and you're giving us nothing in return. They're giving you tons of revenue for reading news that you're promoting, and you're taking that revenue for yourselves and doing nothing with it. And, you know, I mean, maybe with the UK should be doing this, because actually in Australia, Google paid $100 million Aussie dollars in tax last year. And the UK paid £44 million. So, you know, it equates to about the same, but the difference being the UK's population is three times that of Australia. So the rate of tax being paid in Australia by Google versus the UK is actually exponentially higher. So maybe we should be doing something similar, but Australia is still arguing that actually the tax from the ad revenue, which equates to a 4.6 billion Aussie dollars, is actually coming out of Singapore, where they charge lower rates of tax. So all ad revenue is being booked in Singapore, and Australian Google sees themselves very much as an agent. So this is the entire reason why the ACCC are going down this route in the first place. And I think it's a really smart reason. I think that other markets definitely look to it and go, there's something to this. We could start trying something similar.
And it's going to be really interesting to see how this unfolds, right? Because, you know, I'm surprised actually at what I feel like is the lack of sophistication of Google's positioning and argument at the moment. You know, everything that they've put out seems either very, you know, transparent, you know, it's easy to see that they are arguing for their own vested interests, or they're trying to put out sort of slightly complex arguments about how they'd have to change some of their services or how users' personal data might be at risk, which are contradictory and easy to prove to be misinformation. Google's got a lot of money. Surely they could employ better PR specialists here. Surely they could employ better media and comms specialists. Like, what the hell? And so that makes, where is this actually going to go, though? Because the ACCC are clearly not going to back down, and nor should they, because that's their remit, right? They're a public funded organization that are specifically there to hunt down anti-competition. So they should keep going until they have nowhere else to go. But you've got to imagine Google's got a lot of money, and to throw at litigation if they needed to, or to throw at other tactics, and I'm surprised they haven't employed any of those yet, tactics being one.
I think it will really open the doors, and I think this isn't, you know, the last we're going to see of this. I think this will just
Lindsay gets called in the middle of it. Sorry, Kat.
No, that was really it. It was just to say that it was, I think this will escalate, and I think this will just open the doors for lots more discussion around this.
Yeah. I suppose the one thing I like too, and I'd be interested in both of your points of view on this, is I'm enjoying the fact that this is really bringing that whole conversation about the value exchange of journalist-created content to the fore. I mean, we've been talking about a lot in our industry for quite a while, and I know it's been getting a lot more commonplace as a discussion, value exchange, what's the, you know, why do people sort of, you know, pay for content, but this feels like it's now a totally legitimate argument. You know, there's a wave of support behind that point of view that, okay, if news and content creators are going to pay journalists to create good quality research, you know, journalistic content, someone has to pay for that.
Yeah, so I think the value exchange element is obviously a conversation that we've been having more and more in this industry in general. And I think that we've always talked about there are certain markets where the consumer understands the value exchange. And actually, China is often a market we've talked about where the data exchange there is something that the consumer will go, yeah, no, I know the government's taking my data, but in exchange, I get this, this, and this. And that for me is perfect. It's all free. And actually, that's out in markets outside of that, that's been always been a struggle. I think this conversation, and hopefully the ACCC are helping to communicate that effectively to the average consumer. We're doing this for you to help you guys understand what your value is to these big tech companies. And that is the important message here. You guys are providing these big tech companies with the revenue to keep them doing business and keep them growing. It's all down to you guys using their services. Hopefully the average consumer will be able to understand that more effectively with what the ACCC is trying to achieve.
100%. Time's up. Let's move on. And also, Lindsay, you were sounding a little bit like a Dalek there. Hopefully that was just me.
Oh, God.
My internet connection. I know. Otherwise, poor Rodney, sound guy, is going to have a hard time. Okay, let's move on to the third news story, which is about another very public spat, this time between Apple and Epic Games. I mean, it's really been quite a fun week for news, hasn't it? Just sitting back and watching these multi-billion dollar companies go and slap one another and then slap each other back. Okay, so Apple, obviously, are having a falling out with Epic, who are the creators of Fortnite, amongst that's one of probably a number of games. I'm looking at you, Lindsay, when I say this. Surely they create more than Fortnite.
Well, it's mostly Fortnite, basically Fortnite.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. The creators of Fortnite, Apple are threatening to block Epic Games by prohibiting their game creation tool, Unreal Engine, to access the iOS operating system. So Epic are retaliating on this by trying to pull together a game publisher coalition of Apple critics to raise awareness of the damage that this will do broader to the industry. Now, where all of this started is a row over Apple's 30% App Store levy for app publishers monetizing their games. So the notion is that Apple takes somewhere between 15 to 30% of in-app monetization, in-app sales as commission for operating that app through the App Store. And app developers have been pretty pissed off about this for quite some time, claiming that it's unfair. There's been a couple of other fairly public falling outs between Apple and other app developers. But this time, Epic, and they're not the only game developer to have done this, by the way, have implemented an in-app monetization tool that sort of circumvents the App Store. So they're basically monetizing Fortnite via other routes outside of the App Store. And Apple have said that's in... that directly contravenes the terms and conditions of making an app available through the App Store. So they've blocked them from the App Store, and this is a further iteration of that. Now, I'm really interested to hear your points of view on what's going on here for between these two, but also what's going on here from Apple's perspective. You know, we know that, rowing back a couple of years, Apple's business was really in hardware. Now they're in a position where they're needing to make money off other services, and App Store must make them an enormous amount of revenue. Epic's a big game to be sort of having this argument with. And so it obviously feels as though they're picking a fight with somebody that's actually got a little bit of strength in this particular scenario. So I'm interested in your point of view on Apple's business and, you know, what they're looking to achieve from this, and also where you think this particular battle might go, bearing in mind that gaming is just such a big growth industry. It's seen a huge uplift during the pandemic, and it's an area as well that, you know, in the advertising and marketing industry, we can see a lot more brands flocking to for potential advertising opportunities. Lindsay, what's your point of view on this?
I mean, there's so many different facets to this. I think to kick off with the latter part of what you're saying, from the advertiser perspective, you know, we've had this conversation with advertisers when it came to Safari blocking third-party cookies with ITP. And advertisers generally come out and say, you know, our only alternative is to throw more money into Google and Facebook. And that's what we'll do. If we can't put money into this sector, we'll have to put it here instead, because they make it easy for us. They give us measurement, they allow us to target, et cetera, et cetera. So I do feel like advertisers that have only just started getting to grips with in-app advertising and understanding how they can target a gaming audience more effectively are kind of going to be kind of, you know, hit for six a bit here, and we'll have to kind of work out another strategy if this becomes a real problem that means that, you know, you are unable to effectively advertise to, you know, if games or apps in general are pulling out of the App Store in vast swathes on top of iOS 14 with the kind of the IDF removal of IDFA as well. But I think that we talked last week on the podcast about Apple also not allowing Microsoft xCloud and Google Stadia to have their apps on the App Store unless Apple could review every single game on their respective platforms. And it just, for me, highlights the size of Apple, and that Apple is a force to be reckoned with, and Epic believe they can reckon with them. And I don't know if Epic can reckon with them. And that's what this coalition that Epic's trying to form sort of represents. Epic have seen they can't do it alone, you know, and they did break the T's and C's of the App Store, but they did it on purpose. They knew they were doing it. They did it to kind of make a point. And Apple have come back and said, we can't make an exception just for Epic, just because Epic isn't big enough. You know, we can take down, we can remove those 30% levies for Epic. Epic don't want you to give them an exception. Epic are trying to use their heft to fight for the industry and fight for something that has annoyed people, annoyed app developers, not just gaming, app developers for a long time. But gaming companies tend to play by their own rules, which is why it makes sense that it's the gaming companies more so than the other non-gaming companies that are the ones trying to take the fight against Apple.
Yeah, definitely. Kat, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many relevant points there, and I agree with a lot of those. And I think, you know, firstly, it was bound to happen. Okay. The fees are high. And it's also Apple. So I think that was going to happen. Also, you know, the free Fortnite ad was an absolute huge statement. You know, I'm assuming you both saw that, and that's, yeah, you know, that's such a backlash on that. I mean, incredible ad. You know, forming a coalition to tackle Apple is a big statement. Will it work? I'm not 100% sure. But I think that, as I said, it was bound to happen. Someone was going to do it, and why not Epic? I think the challenge with hitting back at Apple for something is that you have to be really sure on what element it is. And for me, it feels like they may be going after more than just the commission. They're kind of trying to attack part of more of the Apple stack. And so I don't know if that's necessarily the right approach. Who will join that coalition? I'm not sure. But, you know, maybe it is a good thing to open this discussion and to fight, because, like Lindsay said, you've got loads of developers, not just gaming developers, but that can't pay those fees. And, you know, does that mean then we're going to see all of these smaller developers just go and not be able to create anymore because they can't work with Apple in that way? I think what it will do is it will challenge developers, and again, not just gaming, but mainly gaming, to think about different monetization strategies. And, you know, as Lindsay alluded to as well, there's different ways in which they can make money. So, you know, there's a massive rise on in-app audio, for example, and then in-app payments. And I think it's going to mean that these developers are going to have to pivot and think about different ways that they can achieve success and that they can make money, if they, you know, if they're going to have this challenge, an ongoing challenge that they're going to have with Apple.
It's interesting as well, because it's a little bit similar to the Google ACCC story as well. I really feel for smaller app developers here, right? Because they need to be in the App Store in order to get anywhere at all. So then they're forced to pay the commission fees, which they can probably afford a lot less than the bigger developers. No doubt they probably want to speak up and speak out about this, but they can't, they probably don't feel like they've necessarily got the strength to. So it might be tempting for them to, and maybe this is where Epic is going with their coalition idea, it might be tempting for them to join a coalition, but they won't necessarily have the same strength and power to abstain from the App Store or to do anything significant against Apple, because they'll still be so dependent on the revenue that they're getting and the exposure and the installs that they're getting via the App Store. So, you know, it really makes me feel for them. And it also makes me feel like Apple is employing some slightly bullying tactics here. You know, they're really using their position of dominance to stick to their guns. And I can understand from a commercial point of view, why wouldn't they? But it does feel like there needs to be some balance here somewhere, you know. I don't know. And I mean, actually, you know, the T's and C's of the App Store are that they charge between 15 and 30% commission. Now, I don't know how they structure that. Do they structure that on the based on the size of, you know, the developers that are getting their apps in the App Store? Or, you know, there's got to be another way of doing this, right? Because it just feels very unfair, particularly for small independent app developers.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's, you know, it comes back to that point, and we've said this with the other two stories, is it's about regulating, isn't it? It's about, you know, trying to reduce the monopoly, whether it's Apple, whether it's Google, whether it's Facebook, you know, whoever at GAFA as a whole, trying to reduce the monopoly that some of these companies have. And we're going to start seeing this more. And you know, this isn't new either, because Spotify have been, you know, pushing back on Apple for years, for ages. So I think it's just that this is becoming more and more prominent. And for someone like Epic, who are big in themselves, to take such a stance will just open up that conversation and that debate. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this happening.
Mm. Agree. Lindsay, final word?
Yeah, I think, Rachel, your point about, you know, the feeling sorry for the small developers, I completely agree. First of all, Apple blocking Unreal Engine from being able to create any updates. So obviously, Unreal Engine is almost like a democratized engine for allowing high-quality creative to be used in games. It's been developed by Epic, and they get royalties for every developer that uses it. But it's kind of it's an industry-wide thing. There are a couple of engines out there, but it's one of the main ones that everyone uses. So Epic's concern is everyone will go somewhere else. But as a small developer, if I've been using Unreal this entire time, having to kind of start again and use a different engine to build my game and build my creative with, that is a whole problem within itself. And outside of that, you know, Epic trying to build this coalition, as we talked about, No one's really joining it yet. I think Spotify are in talks to join it. They have not joined it, but they have said that they support Epic's stance on this. But if I were a small developer, Rachel, you talked about abstention, like a small developer wouldn't be able to abstain from using the App Store, but also they wouldn't be able to afford Apple chucking them out of the App Store, which is probably the more likely scenario. If anyone is publicly seen to be outing this, Epic have got heft and size behind them, but there aren't that many developers that are as big as them that can do the same thing. So if they're looking to try and create this powerful coalition, there'll be many that will just go, I agree with you, but I can't say it publicly. I'll say it from behind the wings because I can't get involved in this because this is my business we're talking about here.
And that's classic bullying, right? Like that is, I agree, I want to stand up, but I can't because I have to protect my own best interests.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Anti-competition all over again, which we talked about last week. Apple is dangerous. Let's call a spade a spade. Apple is dangerous.
It feels like, oh, out of time. Oh. I was going to say something else, but that's it. Clock's up. Kat, a couple of questions with you, a bit of a Q&A with you before we sign off. We interviewed your co-founder a couple of weeks ago, Jay, and he told us a little bit about Imagine Insights and what you guys get up to. But maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what you're currently working on or some highlights, some things that you've been working on of late that have been of real interest to you.
Yeah, we've actually just completed some amazing work with the NFL. Which has just been incredible. So NFL wanted to create their youth marketing strategy and came to us to engage with our community of 16 to 24 year olds. And we got our community involved in two virtual workshops, and they basically helped to co-create that strategy with them. And we would have done that in person had it not been for lockdown, but actually it worked perfectly virtually. And it's been such an amazing experience, not only to see the ideas and the opinions and the thoughts of these young people who are so incredibly passionate, not just about the NFL, but just about, you know, marketing and sport in general. And also the feedback that we've had from the client has been absolutely amazing. And they've had such an impact from these young people. And to be honest, that's just what makes my job worthwhile. That's what we do it for, is to make sure that young people have a voice and also that our clients benefit from that. So yeah, that's been such an exciting project to work with. And, you know, Jay and I are just doing a lot of PR. It's something that Jay is incredibly good at, and he loves, and you know, any excuse to talk, Jay's there. And then he's trying to get me to do the same, which is why I'm obviously doing lots of podcasts now. I'm really enjoying that side of things as well. So and you know, the business is a startup, we're still really small, but it's really exciting and we're growing super fast. So it's really, really, really exciting times.
I mean, it must be, I mean, like you say, it's obviously really satisfying work, engaging with the community of young people who are really enthusiastic about it, and also being able to, you know, provide those insights to clients that you work with. But it also must be very powerful, particularly for clients, kind of coming out with ideas and then putting them in front of, you know, an audience of potential young consumers and getting really honest feedback back. I mean, I think Jay mentioned that when we chatted with him a few weeks ago. He's like, these people will tell you what they really think, right? Like there's no filtering, principally because that's what you've asked them for, but also too because young people are quite often really confident with their points of view, which is fantastic because you are getting these really genuine, you know, pieces of insight. So tell me, you know, presumably the clients obviously use this to roll into their marketing and advertising strategies, or maybe even their product strategies and brand building. But what is the response like from clients? How do they deal with these, you know, with this sort of really bold and refreshing insights from young people?
Yeah, I mean, it's you hit the nail on the head there. They are so incredibly honest. And the difference between, let's say, millennials and Gen Z is that millennials will do prep for ages, you know, to think about their opinions and to write stuff down. And then you talk to Gen Z and they're literally just roll it off the tongue and tell you exactly what they think with no filter. And I think what's great with the brands and the agencies that we're working with is that they're open to that feedback. And I think that has to be the first step. So, you know, there's no point saying, oh yes, let's engage with your community, and then we're not going to use your opinion, or we're going to take offense to some of the things you have said. That you have to be completely open. And a good example actually is when we ran a workshop ourselves you know, our prior name, company name, they basically told us it was crap. You know, they said they hated it and it didn't mean anything and it didn't stand for anything. So that was great for us because it just meant that we could completely change what we're doing based on the feedback of our community. But for brands and agencies, it's really that first step of being open to that feedback and then being willing to change as a result. And, you know, for I often speak about an example, you know, if you're trying to create, let's say, a femcare campaign for a 16-year-old girl, female, then why would you not consult with that audience first before you created that campaign? And that's really how we're trying to encourage brands and agencies to think of it, is just consult with the end user, whether that be, you know, branding, product, marketing, you know, that's the valuable audience, and having that insight is second to none.
Yeah. Like I said, so powerful. It must be, yeah, really enjoyable work, I imagine. And then I suppose I was also just thinking, the last point I was going to make before we ran out of time for our last story was, it feels like the world is coming to a bit of a crescendo of kind of challenging these big corporate organizations. You know, obviously I meant that comment in relation to the three news stories we discussed earlier, but I wonder if there's a bit of an atmosphere and an attitude of that when it comes to big consumer brands as well. And I wonder if young people have got that in the forefront of their mind, thinking that, you know, not just having the confidence of youth or whatever, but also there seems to be a bit of a landscape at the moment where it's okay to challenge things. It's actually okay to stand up and say, no, I think actually that's really rubbish, or I don't understand that, or that doesn't mean anything to me. You know, I feel like we're, you know, maybe riding a wave of it's okay to speak up and say that things are not the way that you would like them to be. Am I making that up, Kat, or do you?
So yes, you're completely right. Gen Z are an activist generation. So they will stand up for what they believe. They will tell you what they think. And, you know, they're not afraid to do that. And you can see that with some of the movements and especially in politics, and the way that they're so passionate about trying to create change. And, you know, some of it comes back to the fact that they are, you know, digital native generation, right? So they have a lot more access to information. They will search, they will research, they will, you know, think about all the access they have to data and to news and to all of those things, and then form their opinions. And so, yeah, you are completely correct. They will tell you what they think and they will stand up for it.
And I think it's then just on behalf, you know, it's just incumbent upon brands and organizations to be brave enough to handle that, right? And
yes.
And then we could see some really interesting things happen as a result.
Completely. It's really that if you can be open to hearing that and to making change, then you're going to succeed in you know, in our industry.
Yeah. Fabulous. Okay, we've run out of time and, run out of patience to deal with everybody's Wi-Fi connections and Dalek sounding.
I'm so sorry.
No, yeah, don't be.
I'm sorry, guys.
No, don't be. I think we had a few issues all around. That's why. Anyway, never mind. Rodney, you'll have a bit of a job on your hands this week.
Thank you, Rodney.
Yeah. But thank you very much, Kat. It was a pleasure to have you as a guest on the Mad Tech podcast this week. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And that was this week's Mad Tech podcast.